Well, hello, and welcome back to our study of the Corinthian letters. My name is Bob. Today, we're still in chapter 7. I think we're going to finish chapter 7 today and move on into chapter 8. The chapters is not as important as the topic, of course. Topic being marital matters. And we had just talked about, the woman who is unmarried, the man who is unmarried, how they care for the things of the Lord, and so on. So he's dealing with individuals who are thinking of marriage and asking him questions about it, but they ask him another question, and that is, what about my daughter? What about my daughter who is not married? Now, this is hard, very difficult for Western ears to hear, what we're about to talk about today. That a father would have this kind of authority over his child. Now there are, we want to underscore here that there are Christian parents in this country who are so respected by their children that their children will listen to that advice about marriage and about the particular person. It does happen, but it is rare. It wasn't so rare in the day that Paul was talking about. In fact, there was a legal matter. I mean, you just didn't go against the wishes of father and mother. Although a good father would listen to his daughter and try to make her happy. But every once in a while, you know, a father really does know what's best for his child. That's, again, very hard for some to hear, but it is true. If any man thinks that he's acting unbecomingly, improperly, he's not acting right toward his virgin. Now, the word daughter follows in most texts here, but it's in italics, meaning that word daughter was not in the original Greek text, but it was added by translators because it made sense with the context. And for the most part, you can trust those additions. Not always. Translators do a little bit of interpreting now and then, and that's what's being done here. There are texts that just leave the word virgin and make this whole context about a man and a woman again. But we've already had that context in the chapter, and it doesn't quite make sense. Frankly, as you go on down through these verses, it wouldn't quite fit with just a man and his girlfriend, his fiance. So we're going to go with the wisdom of many of the translators and the context itself. It's talking about virgin daughters. If you think, sir, father, that you haven't been treating your daughter right, maybe she's getting a little old. That's what it says next. If she's past her youth. Now, that's interpreted so many different ways. 12, 20, 30, I don't know. I'm not going to put an age on there. But the father knew. The culture knows what is considered young and what is considered, why is that person not married yet? And so if that's what was happening here, you got a daughter, she's getting a little older, and people are starting to cause her a little grief, and she's starting to feel rejected, disgraced, reproached, embarrassed. If you got a problem like that, and if it must be so, that's what I read in the New American Standard, and if it must be so, not sure what all is entailed there. Has she already met somebody? Is she putting incessant demands on her parents that dad's just got to listen to? If it must be so, if you've got to marry him, go ahead. And Paul says it's okay. Let him do what he wishes. He doesn't sin. He's not sinning by letting her marry. Why would he have to say that? Because that was the question they asked. He didn't think this up. They were asking questions. Is it sinful to, in these times, or even because we're a Christian now, because God expects holiness of his people, is marriage itself a bad thing? Is it okay to let our children marry? No, he says it surely is. You go ahead and let her marry. But then verse 37 comes back at us. But he who stands firm in his heart, this is still dad, being under no constraint. That is, she's not worried about it. There's no suitor there that's pursuing her. And he has authority over his own will. He's not arguing with himself back and forth, should I do this or should I not? Is this the right thing? And no, he has authority. He knows what he wants to do. And he's decided this in his own heart. I'm going to keep her. I'm not going to let her marry. Now, we're not talking about a mean scoundrel here who just makes up rules to hurt people. But he knows his daughter. Yeah, she's maybe a little bit older. But not old enough. Maybe she hasn't shown marks of maturity. Maybe she hasn't learned some of the lessons that mom's been trying to teach her around the house. Maybe she would make somebody a very poor wife right now. Well, there's a lot of reasons why a dad would say, no, not yet, not yet. And it's okay to do that, too. Now, I have to say it's still okay. I don't know that anybody can hear me in this country. Anybody that might happen to be listening to something like this, if you pass this on to church members in your church, I imagine you'll be laughed out of church. It's just not done where a father says no and the daughter says, yes, I'll agree with you. I will obey you. I said earlier, yes, there probably are situations like that throughout the country, but they are rare. They're so rare, and it is very sad that children, and they are still children, think that they really do know better, and we sigh about it, but we let them just go ahead and do it. In those days, you could make it stand. You could make it stick. No. My no means no. He stands firm in his heart, verse 37. He's under no constraint. Nobody's going to push me to do something. I just know from God it's not time. He's not the man. If maybe that was the situation, there's a guy there that just would not be an appropriate husband. Today, the girl will whine and cry, and eventually dad caves in. But here's a guy, here's a father. If he caves in, it's still okay, according to Paul. He's not sinning, let her marry. But if he stands firm against all this pressure, and I suppose mom's putting it on him too, oh my, you get a mom and a daughter teaming up, what's a dad to do? Well, every once in a while there's a verse 37 kind of man, a man that knows how to stand firm in his heart. Not constrained in this way. He has authority over his own will, he has authority in the house. And they listen to him, not because he's a tyrant, but because he's a loving, wise man. So then, both, verse 38, he who gives his own virgin daughter in marriage does well. It's okay if you yielded to the pressure, and it just seemed like it had to be, and it's okay to marry. Just let him go. But he who does not give her in marriage, in that situation, would do better. If dad has already decided, he's looked out over the landscape and he realized this is not good, and he says no, Paul says that would be better. He's not saying marriage, and he's not comparing marriage to not marriage. He's comparing a wise father to a father that's maybe gives in to pressure too easy. Now that's one topic. Then another topic comes up. What do we do with the longevity of marriage? How long is a wife bound? Well, as long as her husband lives, she is bound to him. But if her husband is dead, she is free to be married. I've run into people every once in a while who just never married again, even though the husband or the wife died very young. They just never marry again. Not because they didn't want to, they just didn't feel they were allowed to. But God, through the Holy Spirit, through the apostle, says, yeah, it's okay. When that marriage contract has been finalized by death, well, it's okay. Jesus even sets people free who says they can be married, divorced, if there's unfaithfulness, because that breaks the marriage contract too. But I like what Paul says. Oh, and by the way, at the end of verse 39, yeah, you can marry, but only that person that's in the Lord. There's no question about that in the Scriptures. We are not to marry outside of the family of God, outside of our nation. In Israel's time, it was Israel was the nation. You don't marry the Canaanites. You don't marry anybody else. You just marry a Jew, Jewish people. Christians are to marry Christians, God's people. Keep it in the family, God's family. But he said, you know, in my opinion, this is Paul speaking in his opinion, but remember, his opinion's a good opinion. She'd be happier, this woman, if she remains just like she is, unmarried. Now, how does Paul know? He had made the case earlier in the chapter that it's much better to marry than to burn. Now, here's a woman, though, that maybe is a little older, been married, and just might just confuse things in her mind. Again, it's okay to remarry. You're totally free. But he says, long term, overall, probably be better if she didn't. That's my advice. That's my opinion. And he says, you know what? I think I also have the Spirit of God. A lot of people have jumped on that. Said, Paul wasn't even sure of his own salvation. Oh, no. Please, this is a little bit of sarcasm here. You guys think you're so powerful in the Spirit, Paul says. I think I have the Spirit of God, too. He's saying it half-jokingly. I have the Spirit of God. When I give my advice, I give it as a Spirit-filled man, not in my carnality, not in my flesh, not what I like, but I just have some wisdom here that lets me know that unmarried, especially if you've been married a long time anyway, unmarried would probably be a better situation for you. You could confuse things. But no law there. No law. Well, let's go to another issue. When we go to another chapter here, chapter 8, we go to another issue. And this issue has to do with things sacrificed to idols. It's a question that they had. They're bringing him all these questions. Let's talk now about things that are sacrificed to idols. Although that's the immediate issue, the real issue in this chapter, and really I think about three chapters here, is liberty. And the extent of liberty, and how free are we really? And where does liberty end? What are the restrictions on liberty? And if we put restrictions on liberty, is it really liberty, some would ask? And the answer is a very good one, I'm sure you'll agree. We thought that 1 Corinthians 13 was about love, but 1 Corinthians 8 starts talking about love also, because he compares love to knowledge. Compares love to knowledge. First, he says, here's the issue. Things sacrificed to idols. All right, now let's start talking about it. He starts talking about love and knowledge. He says, we know that we all have knowledge. We know stuff. We know what is right and wrong. We know our Bibles. We know what the apostles have said. We know what the Spirit is saying to the churches. We know. What does that knowledge do for you? Paul says, if knowledge just remains knowledge, all it does is inflate you. It fills you full of hot air. You get bigger and bigger. You get proud, puffed up. In New American Standard, the word is arrogant. Okay. But love builds up, makes you strong. There's a puffing up and there's a building up. Love, knowledge makes me arrogant. Love builds up you. He wants to compare these two things before he goes on with the discussion. A lot of you folks, he says in verse 2, you think you know something. You don't know anything yet. You just think you know something. You haven't yet known anything as you ought to know it. There's a way to know something. And the way to know it is the way of love. And if anyone loves God, he gets involved in a special kind of knowledge. And that's the knowledge that God has of him. That's verse 3. If anyone loves God, he is known by him. So when we're talking about knowing stuff, the thing that we ought to be focusing on is God knowing stuff. God knowing us. And if we love God, God knows us. That means he recognizes us. He has a certain approval of you. He has a knowledge of you that's different. Now, he knows you anyway. But I'm saying when you do the right stuff, and when you love him, you know that there's a recognition that's coming from heaven. A knowledge that's the kind of knowledge you want to have in your system. Not the knowing of facts in the Bible, although you should know that too, for sure. That's why I teach these things. I want you to know this. But there's a higher and better knowledge, a knowledge that has to do with the knowing of God and the loving of God. When you got that in you, that kind of answers some of these issues that we've been talking about. So then he goes back to the issue. He really was on the issue, but he's going back to what seems to be the issue. This thing of eating of things sacrificed to idols. Now, in Corinth, I imagine many cities throughout Greece and throughout the world, pagan religions prevailed. Part of pagan religion was a little bit like the Jewish religion, where you had a sacrifice of an animal. And, of course, they didn't throw away all that good meat. The priests would eat it in Judaism. There'd be other ways that meat could be disposed of, but not thrown out. It was taken to the feast. It was taken to the temples, and people just ate it. This was food, meat, animals that had been sacrificed to idols. Now, does that meat have any special power in it? Not at all. Do you know that? I know that. I know that. And a lot of people back then knew that. And Paul said, okay, your knowledge is cool. You know stuff. But people who take that attitude, hey, it ain't nothing to this. What's wrong with you guys? It ain't nothing in meat. Yeah, that's true. But you're not showing any love when you say it like that, when you have this arrogance about you. We know, he says, we have this knowledge, verse 4, that there is no such thing as an idol in the world. He didn't mean that there weren't physically idols, because there are. He meant that those idols were nothing. They were just nothing. Later on, he's going to talk about demons being behind them. But the idols themselves were just what they looked like, just pieces of rock, statues of nothing. There was no God. There's no other God. We know that. Only one God, Paul says. Knowledge. Verse 5, he goes on with this. There are a lot of so-called gods. People name things in heaven and earth. They say, this is a God, this is a God, this is a God. Many gods, many lords, if you're just talking about the so-called stuff, verse 5. But for us, we know. And this is obvious. Simple to us. There's but one God. The Father. From whom are all things. And we know that. That's basic Christianity. And we exist for him. Paul taught them that many years ago when he was there in Corinth, I'm sure. That was just basic ABC stuff. And then there's one Lord, Jesus Christ, by whom are all things. And when he says, by whom are all things, he makes him one with the Father, because the Father is the Creator. We know that God created the heavens and the earth, but it says here that Jesus did. So what does that tell you? And he says, we exist through him. We live through him. Now that's clear knowledge. But, verse 7, not everybody has this knowledge. You know, the implications of the teaching that we're in the middle of here are very widespread, are very, very important for us to know, because they can apply in a myriad of ways. Think of some stuff that you know, and you should be glad that you know it. You're happy that you know it, but that other Christians at this point don't know, and could be a problem if you used your knowledge and you went ahead and did some stuff and showed up some places and said some stuff based on your knowledge, but not based on theirs. It's a lot of things we know. The definition of sin. Certain things about sins that we know. If you would tell them certain things, Would that be wise? Love does not always permit us to tell everything all the time. Our mouth just has to keep running. Your mouth is connected to your brain. And it's the brain that gets us in a lot of trouble, that human carnal mind. You've got that, all that knowledge in there, even though it's holy stuff, it's processing through your brain and wants to come out your mouth. God says, wait a minute. Well, what about the clothes you wear? You know that there's certain clothes that are fine, but they're questionable to others. Well, what about the places that you show up? What about your Christmas tree? You say, well, come on, there ain't nothing wrong with no Christmas tree. I mean, it's just this green plant that I just got cut down out of the forest I brought in, and I decorated. It has nothing to do with what they used to think it had something to do with. I just like the colors. It's beautiful. Yeah, but not everybody has that knowledge. Not everybody thinks like you're thinking. Some people believe, just like the meat sacrificed to idols, that these Christmas trees are about idolatry. And that you're committing idolatry by putting that tree up in your house. That's what they think. That's just a couple things that come to my mind. There are so many other things that are out there that are issues that we wrangle with other people about. Rather than wrangling, we should determine in our minds, what does love demand? Verse 7, not everybody has this knowledge, but some of these people that don't know what you know about God, they're used to thinking in terms of the idol, even until now. That's what they were raised with. That's what they were born believing. And they go ahead, because of you and your freedom to go ahead and eat this stuff, they go ahead and they eat it, but in their minds they're thinking, oh my, this was sacrificed to an idol, but they're still eating it. You're thinking, I don't really care if it was sacrificed to an idol. I know there is no idol, blah, 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 blah. But they're thinking, I don't know. I don't feel good about this. That means their conscience, which is a holy thing, their conscience is being defiled. You see, what your conscience tells you is holy until that conscience is reprogrammed. The conscience is changeable and must be changed and renewed regularly by God. The conscience is not God, but the conscience is fed by God, and people pick up little bits and pieces and it goes into their conscience and they say to themselves, this is right, this is wrong. We have different lists. We all have different lists, but my list is important to me. And because of that, if you as a strong brother do something that I as a weak brother cannot do, and I see you do that and I want to keep up with you, I might bend my conscience. I might defile that holy thing that God's put in me to tell me right and wrong just to keep up with you because you think it's all right. That's verse 7. They're thinking this thing's been sacrificed to an idol, and they're looking at you eating freely and happily, and so they start eating. But they just wounded their conscience. Now he says, food is not going to commend us to God. You know, if I eat this stuff that's sacrificed to idols, if I don't eat it, God's not really worried about that. But, and he says, we're neither the worse if we don't eat it, or the better if we do. But there it is again. Take care. Take care. That this liberty of yours, this liberty that's based on your knowledge, your arrogance sometimes, doesn't somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. So you see, the liberty, the knowledge says there's one God. Love says don't defile that person's conscience. Liberty says it doesn't matter what I eat, and that's true, but love says don't be a stumbling block. You see how liberty and love check each other? If someone sees you, verse 10, you have this, quote, knowledge, dining in an idol's temple, or we might say going to a movie, or going to a place where liquor is served. Oh, you don't drink it, but you go to the place where it's served. And the other brother comes in right after you, sees you in this place, thinks it's okay to serve, have the liquor too, because he's had liquor all of his life, and he sees you in this place where it's being served. Did I say it's wrong to go to that place? No. Your liberty says, I can go. Your knowledge says, sure, I can go. Your love says, never again, if that person is going to be hurt. Sees you who have knowledge dining in an idol's temple, won't his conscience, if he's weak, be strengthened to eat things sacrificed to idols, or drink, or go to movies that are worse than the one that you went to innocently? For through your knowledge, your knowledge, he who is weak is ruined. He's the brother for whom Christ died. Do you love that brother? Do you love that sister? Would you like to see him in trouble with God? Would you like to see him struggling for a relationship with God because they keep bending their conscience to please you? That's sinning against the brothers. When you take too much liberty, liberty is a good thing. Oh, liberty is a good thing. But when you take too much liberty, you hurt your brothers. You wound their conscience. You sin against Christ. That's pretty clear, don't you think? Paul makes this statement, and let it be yours, and let it be mine. Therefore, if food, that kind of food, food that's sacrificed to an idol, or going to a movie, or going to that restaurant where liquor is served, or anything would cause my brother or sister to stumble and fall and hurt themselves and maybe not even get up again, I'll not do that, any of that. As long as this world stands, I will not do it, so that my brother will have a good shot at being victorious in his Christian life. Do you love that much? Do you understand that love limits liberty? We are free, but our love limits that freedom. Very, very important teaching, don't you think? Well, I do. God bless you. We're going to end it there, since we're at the end of another chapter. Chapter 8 is a real quickie. We'll come back to chapter 9, Lord willing, next time. Be sure to study that. Be ready for that lesson. Thanks for joining me today. By God's grace, we'll be back soon. I've written and recorded, by the way, many other teachings on sermon audio, and I invite you to check them out. I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.